I love preaching on this passage around Veterans Day. It's one of my favorite passages. I actually wrote my thesis on this passage, was one of the chapters. Because this is a very interesting battle scene about a long time war that had been going on between Israel and the Arameans, which is now modern day Syria, around that area. It had been going on for a long time. But as you read this passage, you find that this war has absolutely nothing to do with religion. You find distinct differences between how the kings of the nations treat the war versus the soldiers. And at the end, you have a very godly and peaceful solution. It is one of the most strange and wonderful texts in the whole Bible. So, do we all understand the problem that was going on at this point? They're having land disputes, right? There are border disputes because there's not enough resources for everyone. There's not enough food because at this point, people had agriculture, but not to the same degree that we have now. They don't have the modern technology and engineering. Year to year, depending on how the weather went, you could have a plentiful year, you could have a drought year, and people could, you know, their entire livelihoods, their health would be wavering back and forth, up and down, year to year. So the more space a particular nation could conquer, the better off their people would be because the more land you could use to raise food and crops and such. So there's always going to be border skirmishes over this part of land and that part of land. Do you see that? So Israel was doing okay, and the Arameans kept trying to raid the borders to get more land and to steal supplies. You know, they'd go in and steal livestock. They'd steal grain out of the granaries and these sorts of things. All of the nations were doing this. This was a constant struggle for resources. Now, the Arameans have a problem because they keep trying to attack Israel. But every time they're about to attack Israel, God sends a little message to the prophet Elisha and says, they're going to raid this area next. Or they're going to come and try and ambush you here. And he tells the king of Israel, beware. And then when the Arameans get there, Israel just isn't there. Or they go to try and hide in an ambush, and they find themselves confronted by superior forces. And this keeps happening. So every time the king of Aram tries to make a battle plan, he's thwarted. And after it happens 5, 6, 7, 10 times, he starts to suspect that there's a traitor in his midst. Does that make sense? Because he doesn't know how this is happening. He just knows that every time he tries to make a secret mission, the Israelites already know about it. So he assumes that someone in his midst is a saboteur and is working for the other side. So he calls all of his generals in and says, all right, who is it? Who's the traitor? Who's the one who's telling the Israelites what we're doing? Every single time. Do you see how he's like very, very suspicious, almost to the point of paranoid? And they say, listen, it has nothing to do with us. There's this dude named Elisha. They call him a man of God, which is another word for prophet. And he's the one that keeps giving a heads up to the king of Israel, which is why you keep losing these battles before you even get there. So he responds in a very kingly fashion, right? Well, go get him and bring him to me. And I'll, you know, be able to kill him or lock him up or do whatever we're going to do. So his response to a perceived threat is with violence. Do you see that? Go get him, bring him, seize him, and bring him to me. And then we'll torture him, we'll beat him up, we'll throw him in jail. We won't let him go. We might kill him. We're not sure yet. But since I have that power, once I have him under my control, that will be my solution to this problem. Do we all see that? Okay, so thus begins a wild adventure. The king of Aram sends his troops out to go try and find Elisha. Now, Elisha, he's camping out. He's hanging out. He's got an assistant with him. They're camping out in a valley someplace in a tent surrounded by mountains. They're having a nice time. Well, his assistant gets up early one morning and comes out of the tent and looks out and sees the army of the Arameans in the hillsides above him and surrounding him. And he realizes it's an entire army against two people. This is the problem. He knows they're surrounded. He knows they're toast. Do we all get that? You're still with me? Okay. So as we're talking about this, and as we listen to the news, we hear a lot about, you know, wars. We hear a lot about conflicts. We're hearing a lot about Israel and Palestine. We're hearing about the conflict in Syria. We're hearing about the Ukraine and Russia. We're hearing about what's still happening in Afghanistan and Iraq. And it's really easy to get into us versus them It's really easy to get into enemies versus enemies, right? We are the enemy, they are the enemy, we're the good people, they're the bad people. And sometimes, because it's really easy to get better ratings on the news, they like to throw religion into the mix on this. So I think it's interesting that about a week ago, on the 5th actually, it was a few days ago, the group Anonymous, have you heard of Anonymous? A group of hackers, they're computer hackers, all anonymous. They claim to represent all genders, all ethnicities, all religions, and some no religions at all, many different countries. They're all working together to empower the people over the governments, just to empower them to strike out at oppression where they see it. And so they decided to do something very interesting and very controversial. They spent about 11 months hacking into Twitter accounts that were run by people that were part of the Ku Klux Klan. And when they hacked into those, they were able to find out all the people they were connected to, and they spent a lot of time pretending to be people, like doing this undercover stuff online, to figure out who was actually active Klan members and where they were. And then around last week, they said, we're going to release all the information we have. We're going to out all of these people that are a member of this organization, which is highly controversial and can lead to all sorts of disasters, right? What if they make a mistake? What if they out someone and this person loses their job and they were wrong? What if war breaks out? What if people start fighting about this? What if violence happens? This is a very interesting and volatile way of handling what they perceive as a threat against their own nation. So they released all this data, and I read the report. It's very, very long. It lists names and names and names and names. It lists all of the states where there are active KKK organizations going on and which cities they're in. But what really struck me was in their opening statement. Did anybody else read this report? Okay. I would encourage you to do so. I would not encourage you to harass anybody whose name is on their list. Okay? Just to be clear. But it's really interesting because their opening statement, after they describe how many months they spent and how they did this and how most of the information they got was public, very little of it was secret information. They found it on Facebook and stuff. They said, we feel it is important to provide accurate information about our observations during this operation. We learned that aside from our striking differences in overall ideology and behavior, we found that many members of the Ku Klux Klan groups actually have a few important similarities to us. For example, they are mostly poor and peed off at the man, except they didn't use the word peed. They oppose government surveillance, and they generally feel persecuted for free thought. Day to day, some Klan members work very hard for very little. This is a common ground we understand all too well. We feel that the ability to find common struggles with those that are very different than ourselves is important, even if they are filled with hatred. We feel that the ability to find common struggles with those who are very different than ourselves is important, even if they are filled with hatred. We will never sympathize with the KKK, but we do desire to understand them and learn about how they see their world. We do see their humanity. We do see their humanity. We respect their right to free thought, and we know their fear of others is wrong. We also know that their behaviors strike fear, anxiety, and terror into others. These will no longer be socially tolerated. What strikes me about this is their emphasis on humanity, even though they see someone else as the enemy, and their recognition that many of these people, and a few of them were very clearly mentally ill, sociopathic, violent offenders. A lot of them were just working really hard. They're not making ends meet. And when they are in an isolated town with lack of education, watching news programs that point them at a scapegoat every single night, they become involved in these organizations. And I think it's really interesting that they delineated that. Instead of labeling them, they found common differences and looked at how two different groups of people under the same circumstances responded differently. You see that? So Elisha's servant comes out of his tent, and he looks up and he sees around the hillsides the Aramean army has surrounded them. And he panics, and he wakes up Elisha and says, oh my God, our goose is cooked. And Elisha says, no, it's not. And he prays that his eyes will be opened because he is blind. He prays that his servant's eyes will be opened. Because he was struck blind, all he could see was an us versus them mentality. They are the enemy. They are about to attack us. It's kill or be killed. And what he sees instead when his eyes are opened in a spiritual manner is God's chariots of fire and God's army surrounding the Aramean army. But what's interesting is that that army does not strike. It's just there. It's just there. And he wasn't able to see it before. Until this point, God never entered the picture. And so the Aramean army comes charging down the hillside towards them. And Elisha prays again and says, God, strike them blind. Shut their eyes. And he does. In a very strange metaphysical way, because they're still able to come up to him, find him in his tent, and talk to him. They just don't recognize who he is. And the word used for this is translated often as dazzling blindness. But it's a very strange word because nobody knows what it actually means. It comes from the root of skin and pull over, but it's not the same word that you would use to describe someone who's blind. There is a word for that, and this is not it. The only other place this appears anywhere in the Bible and anywhere in literature is in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, when the men of the town rush Lot's house and the angels inside strike them blind. It says that they were right there around the house, but they couldn't find the door anymore. Now, even blind people can figure out how to get in and out of a door. Am I right? So this is a very strange metaphysical blindness. So they have this conversation with Elisha, and Elisha says, I'm not the guy you're looking for, but I know where to find him. Follow me. And they say, okay. And they follow him. And this is why it's a very interesting metaphysical blindness, because even though they're technically blind, they're able to follow him up and out of the mountains and get all their equipment on a 13-mile journey back to the center of Jerusalem. So they follow him all the way back to Jerusalem, having no idea that they're actually in Jerusalem and that they're with the guy they came to find the entire time. Now, back in the day, way back in the day, if you study Christian history, what is often told to people, and this is something we'll be discussing in the membership class this afternoon, what's often told to people is that there was Judaism, and then all of a sudden Christ came along, and then you had early Christianity. There was one sect, and it kept going until it suddenly split into the Orthodox Church and then split with Luther's Reformation, and then it started splintering all over the place. But that there was always one church. It was like a nice straight line. Judaism just sort of melded right into Christianity, and it wasn't until several hundred years later that you started having these splinter groups. But the reality was that was never the case. It was never the case. My New Testament professor, Reverend Dr. Richard Rohrbach, was able to identify no fewer than 14 different Christian sects as early as the time of Christ, sometimes up to 20, depending on how you read the evidence. But no fewer than 14, and they all believed different things about Jesus. They all believed different things about God and about the Holy Spirit. Some believed that Jesus was born of a virgin. Some believed Mary was not a virgin. Some believed that Jesus was the Son of God. Others believed that he was just a man who had some special connection to God. Some people believed different things about who he was, about the Holy Spirit, how that worked, and who God was. And yet they all got along. I mean, they might have argued amongst themselves, but there was not violence between these groups. You all still with me? There was not violence between these groups because they were all being persecuted equally by the Roman government. They didn't fight with one another, even though they disagreed fundamentally on what we would consider to be key religious tenets, key doctrine. They did not fight with one another. It wasn't until Constantine converted to Christianity. He was the first one to have a sighting where he was about to go into battle and saw Jesus Christ say, yes, if you go in and fight this battle and convert to Christianity, I will make sure that you are victorious. Which is highly suspicious because that's normally how Jesus grows. Am I right? Jesus does not normally tell someone, go kill a bunch of people and I'll bless it. So he comes back, and it was only when he decided that the national religion of Rome would be Christianity that he said, we can't have all of this division among all these different sects. We're going to pick one, and the rest either have to convert or they have to be slaughtered. And so you have the Council of Nicaea where they picked one and only one firm written down doctrine, and everyone had to adhere. And it was at that point that they all started fighting amongst one another. And there were winners and there were losers. And there were the winners and there were the dead. You still with me? So what's interesting is we get to see, again, on the opposite side of this same battle, another king behave in exactly the same manner. All of these soldiers have been drawn into Jerusalem, somehow not understanding where they're going or who they're following. They've completely lost track of their mission. They find themselves in Jerusalem. Elisha prays that their eyes be opened, and they suddenly go, oh dear, we are in enemy territory. We are surrounded. How did we get here? We've been duped. Not only are we in extreme danger, but having failed our mission, it would be very difficult for us to go back to our king now without severe punishment. They're in a major pickle. You see that? Major pickle. And the king of Israel, who has had nothing to do with this the entire time, he's just been sitting here, not even aware that all of this was going on, suddenly finds himself in possession of a gigantic battalion of prisoners of war. And what's the first thing that he says? Remember what he says? Oh, goody, goody gumdrops. Do I get to kill them with the sword now? Now's my chance. And Elisha looks at him and says, did you capture these people? No. You don't get to, did you? You don't get to, no. No. And you see how the kings, their first response is always violence. Their first response is always to sacrifice the human life. And Elisha says, no, I think God has a different plan here. I think God has a different idea of what could happen here. So there's a book by Karen Armstrong called Fields of Blood. And in it, she talks about how throughout history, religion is generally centered around peace. And she makes the case that it's only when nationalism gets involved, when politics get involved, when states get involved, that it is manipulated to justify going to war, to justify spilling human blood. And it's interesting because at first when I heard this, I thought, no, everybody knows that there's always religion behind every war. But she argues that, for example, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, and Mao were all devout atheists. They would have nothing to do with religion. And all of these things happened when people were extremely hungry, when they were frightened, when their jobs were on the line, when they were having trouble feeding their families. And when people are frightened, they're very, very easy to manipulate. So, the solution is one that's so simple and so elegant. They set the tone thousands of years before Jesus had his last supper. He says, feed them. Elisha tells the king of Israel, do not kill these men. Feed them. Give them some time to rest. And then send them home. So they prepare a big feast and everybody sits down together and breaks bread together and looks each other in the eye. And they see in each other their humanity. And they recognize that even though they may have different ideologies, they're all in the same boat. They're all hungry. They're all tired. They're all overworked. They're all worried about how they're going to feed not only themselves, but their families and their populations. They have a big chat about it. Maybe share a pint. And they go home. And after that, the war stops. Because the warriors, the soldiers were unwilling to go back and fight with people they had broken bread with. And unless they are willing to follow the king's instructions, the king is relatively powerless. You see that? So in this story, we see this stark difference between how the kings behave and how the soldiers behave. We see a war that has nothing to do with religion until God comes in the end and finds a peaceful solution between two diametrically opposed nations. And that's interesting because we see the same pattern with Jesus. Every time he sees people that are at war with each other, he sat them down and broke bread together. He made them sit and eat together. He brought in people from all different classes, all different ethnicities, all different backgrounds to sit and break bread together and differentiated again and again the leadership that was corrupt and the common people who were just trying to scrap their little lives together day after day, find enough food to eat, find a way to live, find a way to get along. And so, as we read this story, I think of all of the wars and how much, so much is being blamed on religion, but how much it's really about power, about property, about money, about territory, and how the religious ideologies in Christianity, in Judaism, and in Islam are all about peace. They're all about peace. They're all about living together, sharing with one another, breaking bread together, and building a world where there is no war. And this story shows us how God can work to make that happen. And it's by sitting together and seeing each other's humanity, breaking bread together, and then going home. Can I get an amen to that?